It now.
How you doing?
Okay, so Professor John Child from, well, you're in the University of Birmingham these days, but you've been everywhere, mate, haven't you? You've been in Aston, you've been in Cambridge.
That's where we first met.
That's right.
And I just missed teaching you by 1 year.
Yes, you did. And you've also been in China. So I'd like to ask you a little bit about some things that relate to your past as a scholar in the Aston School. I'd like to hear something about some of the work you're doing currently. And I'd also like to ask you a little bit about China. So let's begin. When I first knew you, you were very, very famous indeed for your work on organizational design, particularly looking at strategic choice and the way that choice influences the designs that organizations have. Why is organization design important, John?
Well, I think it's important because of the way it does affect the lives of people, not only in work, but indirectly people in the community, because the way you structure an organization offers opportunities for people to either participate in decisions that are made and how resources are deployed or not be allowed to participate. So I think it's, you know, when talks about choice, yes, the strategic choice approach was sort of saying there is a choice in how we do, if you like, design structure and design organizations, which is important for managers to work out to better kind of align the design to their purposes. But it's just as equally, if not more important, I think, to make people aware that any particular way in which an organization is designed that they're working in is not necessarily the only way to do design.
How much freedom is there in design?
Well, because it's, you know, it's always interacting with the factors that motivate people and generate the commitment, I think the choice is almost indefinite.
Bit louder.
I said, because it's always, this issue is always interacting in practice. If we're looking at the impact on performance or the outcomes of an organization, because it's always interacting with how people, with the factors that motivate people and commit them as opposed to alienate them, then I think the choice is actually quite wide, because, you know, ultimately it depends on what is acceptable to people and what is going to enthuse them, and it comes down to people. I mean, actually, that's one thing that any manager will tell you, although they don't often necessarily act on it, that people are the most important resource, but I think it's something that comes out of our academic work.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that is interesting, because, of course, some other colleagues would see very little choice at play in organisational design.
Well, yes, there's a lot of, there are various perspectives from economics and indeed from our own subject that imply that there is little choice, that either institutions or the conditions of a particular industry dictate the way organizations are designed, if you like, but I don't think the evidence is conclusive on that at all. There's a lot of, what is called technically isomorphism, if you like, following fashion and mimicking. Among managers in practice, it's partly what they may pick up at business school, and this mimicking leads to a tendency to follow a standard model or assume there's a best practice, and this could apply to design as well. Again, I think it's unduly restrictive in reality. You can often find within the same circumstances, the same environments, the same economic conditions, different, let's say, firms in this case, that are pursuing different approaches to this issue with, it seems, economically similar results.
Mm. Okay, well, let's shift the focus a little now and let's move to China. You spent a number of years working in the China European Business School there.
Yes.
And you spent some time at the University of Hong Kong as well.
Yes.
So you're in a very good position to have a synoptic view of organizational and management affairs in China. What do you think are the most significant features there at the present time?
Well, it goes back to what Mao said on October the 1st, 1949. China is now standing on its feet. I think now there is such a sense of national renewal that has become an enormous driving force for change, for determination to succeed, and so forth. I mean, what is interesting about China is how what is coming from the country and its tradition is melding, and how it's melding with what they're picking up from the West, because they've gone through quite a long process under their reform of opening up, and that doesn't just mean trade, it's opening up to Western ideas. But they've always insisted on it's going to be Western ideas and practice with Chinese characteristics.
Yes.
And it's fascinating to see how this is working out. I mean, it's very, very difficult to keep up with what's happening. It's changing so fast. It's a massive country, but it is changing like hell.
Yes. One of my colleagues, David Goodman, who's a professor of international studies at my university, says it's impossible to know China. You may know one village or one town or
one province, perhaps.
You know, when the provinces have more people in them than most European countries, very difficult to generalize.
Right.
Looking at Chinese organizations today, I was reading in The Economist the other day that they're now trying to make the move to become world famous brands.
Yes.
Is this going to happen?
It's starting to. A lot of Chinese outward investment takes the form of large state material processing companies like oil companies and so forth, steel companies, looking for raw materials. And of course, this is having a big impact in terms of commodity prices. There is another kind of outward investment, which I think is in some ways more interesting and going to be more significant in the long run, which is where Chinese companies are starting to enter world markets. And they lack two, maybe three key resources, two of which they can buy, the third is more doubtful. One is technology. And some of the recent purchases, like Lenovo's purchase of IBM's PC business, is also purchasing technology, not so much hardware, but some of the company technology. The other is that they lack globally recognized brands. And again, you're seeing a lot of acquisitions to buy these. Now, the third element, which is the more doubtful one, is, okay, you can acquire. But as we know with all acquisitions, how do you make an acquisition work? You've got the managerial capability to operate it. There are a few companies, well, one in particular, which is exceptional and is doing it organically, and that is Haier. Haier is probably the best known international Chinese company in white goods and so on. Mm. And they are taking the bold move of going into the most difficult markets like America and Germany and setting up with local staff and doing it all themselves rather than purchasing. But many Chinese companies have been recently, because they're fairly flush with cash and they're getting financial backing from the government very often as well, are trying to do it through acquisition. Mm. It remains to be seen whether it'll work and how much opposition there may be from local, from the countries concerned.
Yes.
Like the Americans have been, they seem to have finessed this attempt by... the oil company, so to take over an American company.
It should certainly produce enough organization design and organization culture problems to keep chaps like us busy for the next 20 or 30 years.
I think so.
Okay, just on a final note, I've asked everybody this question. I've asked them to talk to today's students of management and to say what they think would be the three most significant things for tomorrow's manager.
Three. Mm-hmm. I can think of two, maybe a third will come along. I think one is really trying to find how to take people with you. I mean, it's been said for many decades, it's as true as a management is getting things done through other people. And it's never more true now. And it's not just getting them done through other people as instruments, the old sort of scientific management approach, you tell them what to do. This we're talking about, you know, again, trite phrases, but they mean something. The knowledge workers, the knowledge economy. We're talking about the competitive edge for firms, at least, and indeed the quality of public services, depending on the initiative and in enlisting the contributions of people who are not foolish and are often, on the whole, getting better and better educated, particularly in the developing countries. So I think engendering commitment is terribly important. And the reverse of that, well, the other side of the coin is, you know, making it worthwhile for people. You know, look at the breach of trust, all the evidence indicating how people are losing trust in their employers, in the government and so forth. What does that mean? It means they're not going to be committed. They don't feel they're either going to become sort of quietized, if that's a word, you know, they're going to withdraw or they're going to become cynical. So I think somehow managing organizations in a way which appear to be, if you like, socially responsible, responsive to the needs of people in them and the community, that's, I would say, the second area, but I see it linked to the first.
Means you won't build the commitment unless you actually repay that in kind, in
exactly,
practice and behavior.
Exactly. I mean, psychologists have talked for some time about the psychological contract, but as well as the economic contract. And these contracts have to be honoured, and they're not honoured if people are welcomed one day and shown the door the next day with downsizing and so forth. And this has, I think, had a tremendous impact on a lot of people's thinking and their attitudes towards their workplaces. So I think that's a major problem area, and I would attach it to wider issues like corporate governance, the stakeholder, you know, taking stakeholders seriously rather than just owners, and the community seriously, and so on. And I think, okay, a third area, very much in the news, but it's very, very, very opposite, is, you know, can we somehow apply the expertise we have developed, or knowledge, let's say, we have developed about organisations, and we have developed knowledge, although there are all sorts of competing perspectives. Can we apply that to help the developing world sort things out better? Because there is a tremendous, I see this even in Brazil, which is not by any means the most backward developing country, a tremendous waste of resource, tremendous chaos and confusion. An organisation surely, you know, can help here. If it can't help that sort of issue and that sort of area, you know, what are we doing it for?
Absolutely.
So I feel quite strongly about that.
I agree very strongly with that. Well, thank you very much indeed for your time, John.
Well,
and
it's been nice to
catch up again.
And I should just say to your students, you're very lucky to have Stuart Clegg as your professor. I mean, you couldn't have a more eminent scholar and more active scholar in the field.
Thank you very much, John.
Okay.